Chapter 5 High Charity, 850 BCE, The Age of Reconciliation. On the blood of my father, on the blood of my sons, with each beat of each heart within my breast, I swear to uphold the covenant. Under the direction of the Sanshayum known as Erno, a Sangheili ranger known as Vil Kathami recited the oath with the other Sangheili, before setting foot on the corvette Vengeful Vitality, the vessel that would take them to Janjur Kham under the command of the Prophet of Inner Conviction. Vil always found the oath thrilling, but later, if he thought about it too much, he felt uncomfortable. He tasted a bitterness. The covenant was relatively new. The writ of union was crafted not so long ago, and within memory the Sangheili had fought the Sanshayum. How many of his bloodline, his egg brothers, had died under the blistering, murderous blasts of the dreadnought. And yet, he served these same Sanshayum. Surrender? It was not surrender. The dishonor of such a thing the Sangheili could not imagine. No, it was alliance. And it was the saving of Sanghelios. Still, here was that bitter taste within his mandibles when he thought of the fallen dead. Could they but speak? Would they renounce the Sangheili as living without nobility? Now there was a crueler irony. Vil lived on a great chunk of what had once been Janjur Kham. It was the homeworld of the Sanshayum, the homeworld of those who had wiped out so many Sangheili. The great mass of stone and soil, about 2 mountains worth, taken up by the dreadnought when it arose from Janjur Kham, had been removed from the keyship and formed into an asteroid. It was to be the foundation of the true pedestal of High Charity. And already there were warrens dug into it, sealed off subterranean fortress-like structures, airtight and almost self-sufficient, where lived Sangheili serving as guards, protectors of the Sanshayum. There were 6 trained Sangheili warriors, and their commander Trok Tonghil filing into the corvette on the launch deck. Just before he stepped into the airlock, Vil's gaze took in the sweeping, curved lines of the iridescent stealth corvette. It was in 2 linked tiers, its middle swollen like a Sangheili slitherer just after the creature had swallowed a hopping slug alive, as if something large was not yet digested in its belly. Like with all Covenant ships, loosely based on an obscure selection of Forerunner designs, there was something organic about the lines of the ship. It emulated the rippling forms found in nature. Just inside, floating blithely from left to right on some engineering mission, was a Hurrigok, a being that defied the contrast between machine and biological organism. The thing, they could not be called a species, not having evolved, had been artificially created, it was said, by the Forerunners themselves, who built them up with nanocellular intricacy to be repair and enhance mechanisms, to act as maintenance engineers for the devices known now as sacred relics. A Hurrigok's snaking head could seem slightly reminiscent of the Sanshayum, to Vil anyway, but the engineer organisms had 3 eye-like sensory nodes on either side of their heads, a large cluster of translucent pink and purple gas sacs, some for elevation, some for propulsion, some for chemical supply, humped over the creature's head. 2 probing, feathery anterior tentacles whipped forward. Each tentacle tip articulated into cilia, microscopically fine at the ends, for working within electro-energetic interfaces and other gear. From its underskirt below rippled 4 other work tentacles. The docile creatures seemed to desire nothing but food and work, and they'd made no resistance when tamed by the Sanshayum. The Hurrigok seemed to be coming along on the expedition, and Vil had worked with the creature before more than once. He recognized it by the particular modeling of its air sacs. This Hurrigok was known as floats near ceiling. It communicated with configurations of its tentacles, and could read some hand signs and certain holographic insignia. The Hurrigok being part of the crew was good, as floats near ceiling was efficient, and Vil always found its presence to be curiously comforting. Perhaps they were soothing because the Hurrigok had no agenda but affecting repair, maintenance, following directions, and the like. The creatures were almost eerily trustworthy. After stepping from the airlock into the ship, Vil saw the Sanshayum leader known as Inner Conviction, the prophet seated broodingly in his anti-grav chair at the foot of the ramp leading up to the bridge of the corvette. An armed steward behind him watched the Sangheili narrowly. Or no, the Minister of Anticipatory Security wasn't coming on the voyage, but there were several other Sanshayum on the stealth corvette. The captain called Vervum, the communications officer Sprague, and a gunner named Malir. But the vessel was outfitted for clandestine activities, not significant space battles, and it occurred to Vil that he and the other Sangheili outnumbered these Sanshayum, who, after all, were of little use in a pitched hand-to-hand fight. Flickering through Vil's mind came an unbidden daydream. He imagined he and his fellow Sangheili taking the ship, slaughtering the Sanshayum, making their way in the corvette back to Sanghelios, settling in secret in some remote part of the world, or perhaps on one of the moons. Instantly, Vil was ashamed of himself. How could he even imagine such a thing? He had spoken an oath, many oaths, a taut and binding knot of vows, all to uphold the covenant. He had bound his soul to the covenant through those pledges. How could he even imagine rebelling? I must reform my thinking, or turn myself in. He must have no more treasonous fancies. Vil carried his satchel and directed energy rifle into the crew's quarters, stowing his gear under a bed, wondering if, after all, he would die on the alien soil of Jonjer Kom. That they had some sort of assignment there was whispered in the barracks. They would be briefed when they reached orbit around their destination. But what it was, and why the ship was going alone to a world known to be seething with hostile apostates, was not known to any but the Sanshayum. The Refuge, an uncharted forerunner shield world. 850 BCE, the Age of Reconciliation. Tirsa had to return to the Hall of Crystal Columns to get his scan cam. He'd forgotten it in his hurry to rush off to the midday meal. The food was mostly the local and quite edible vegetable matter and some artificial meat, the latter from the protein fabricator they had brought with them from Sanghelios. The protein mash was unappealing, but Tirsa was young, and his appetite was strong. There was an assortment of small fauna wandering the shield world. Certain Sangheili had been tasked to use analyzers and discover if they were safe to eat. The Sangheili had high hopes of fresh meat, and soon. Tirsa needed the scan cam in the next room slated for evaluation. It hadn't been of much use in the Crystal Columns chamber. The great transparent pillars, though clearly vibrating with energy, remaining stubbornly resistant to scan or analysis. Enduring bias would have to be called to identify them, Suln had said. And there was enduring bias now up ahead, floating between two columns. It might be here to confirm the use of the room. The shield planet was immense, and it was now well known that enduring bias had lost some of its memory. Oddly enough, it seemed to be emanating an image of the refuge, the shield world itself seen from space, and muttering to itself in an unrecognizable language as it did so. Or was the holograph what it seemed? Tirsa began to doubt it when the flying AI seemed to make the image explode, then come back together, then explode again. Tirsa wasn't sure if he was authorized to talk to enduring bias. He was just a young Sangheili, and enduring bias was a living forerunner relic, a holy thing, and only Suon and Usa and perhaps Ernica the Scarmaker spoke to it, as far as Tirsa knew. But Tirsa had the curiosity as well as the appetite of the young, and he couldn't resist the chance, since no one else was around. "Have you identified the use of this room?" Tirsa asked, walking up. "Oh." Enduring Bias spun to face him, its three electric blue lenses shining down at Tirsa. "I was so absorbed in the external modeling, I didn't notice you come in. I really must realign my peripheral analyzers. I have much work to do on myself. I've been having trouble with internalized visual modeling. I find projecting works better now." "What was that language you were speaking in?" Tirsa asked. "I have developed a habit here, in the course of millennia of conversing with myself as I work. I tend to use the language of the creators. Can I be of service to you?" "Of service? To me?" Tirsa was tempted. Perhaps he could ask Enduring Bias what the truth was about the Forerunners. Had it known them? Were they really gods? Supernatural creatures? If so, why did there seem to be a biological waste disposal system here? Was there such a thing as sacred biological waste? But a more pressing question came to mind. "Were you making pictures of this world blowing up just now?" "Yes and no." "Can that be an answer, yes and no? You've never noticed that many things are a case of both affirmative and negative? In fact, primitive computer systems tend to develop using codes made up of yes and no, 1 and 0, 1110, 1100, and the very structure of the universe might be said to be a fluctuation between yes and no, if we consider quantum effects in particle presence and the original impulse of... But what about the picture of the planet being destroyed? As to that, your leader, Usa Zelas, requested of me to explore the feasibility of activating the Great Disassembler. Its processes may be regarded as a kind of explosion, and then again, it is not a true explosion, but rather an orderly disassembling. However, there is inevitably an admixture of chaos." "The disassembler. Does it relate to this room?" "You make an admirable intuitive leap, possibly the result of background consciousness calculus. Yes, this room is indeed the energy generator and focuser for the process of disassembling. I was here making certain that the process could go forward if needed. I ran a model to check the energy output with my projections of full disassembly. Happily, utter disassembly of this world seems entirely possible." "That's good news. But why would Usa want that disassembly?" "He has not informed me of his underlying purpose." "Won't it kill us all if you just break it all apart in space?" "Now that is another question that's, if not answered affirmative or negative, is answered best by perhaps and perhaps not." "Oh, I see." Tirsa felt a chill in his mandibles and down his spine. "I must prioritize now and depart from your ever so agreeable companionship. Suon has transmitted a summons to me. Good algorithms to you, young Sangheili." And Tirsa watched with growing dread as Enduring Bias flew away, talking obscurely to itself as it went. Covenant Vessel Vengeful Vitality, near High Charity, 850 BCE, the Age of Reconciliation. The Vengeful Vitality hummed with energies held barely in check as it prepared to generate a slipspace portal. McCann, the prophet of inner conviction, could feel the chained power of the vessel vibrating under his chair as he approached the rear launch deck. He wished he could step off the chair here, but but it would confuse the Sangheili. It was a curious thing. One could not feel much when the mighty dreadnought, unthinkably gigantic as it was, travelled through space. But the smaller the vessel, the more one felt, as if the smaller ships were more reactive to gravitational fields, radiation, and the minute particles flitting through the void. McKen found that he enjoyed the sensation. There was something romantic about it. It must be like being on the naval vessels, sailing the seas of Jonjur Kom, back in the old days, when San Shyum were physically strong, and the ships were made of wood. McKen eased his chair closer to the insertion dropship. A relatively compact troop transport, the vessel was shaped like Isla Fula, the humpbacked shelled creatures found in San Shyum's oceans, a purplish-blue transport that, like the corvette, was capable of merging visually with a backdrop for stealth purposes. It had room in it for 3 San Shyum, Sangheili, and as many as 10 San Shyum females in the specially fitted cargo chamber at the small ship's posterior. The females would not be terribly comfortable there, but their trip back to the ship would be a short one. They would either make it or be shot down in short order. Trok Tonghil, the scarred old Sangheili commander, missing part of one of his lower jaws due to some old military encounter, stood by the open hatch into the dropship. To his side stood a young Sangheili soldier McKen knew only as Phil. It was his impression that Trok was Phil's uncle. But with the Sangheili, he understood, an uncle was almost the same as a father, and sometimes was the father, though direct paternity wasn't revealed in the bloodline. A Hurrigok was floating out the hatchway, and as it came, it signed with a contortion of its lower tentacles to Vil. Floats near ceiling signals that the vessel is in working order in all systems. Perhaps the Prophet would like to inspect it himself, Trok suggested. No, McKen said, glancing at Vil. The young Sangheili must be bright to have so quick a comprehension of Hurrigok sign language. If the Hurrigok claims it's functional, then it is so. I would only, perhaps, collide my chair into some control panel and make it non-functional again. But you are scheduled to take part in the excursion expedition, Trok pointed out unnecessarily. You will have to enter the vehicle at that time. Do you wish to have your chair adjusted? The Hurrigok could do it. Trok seemed to have an air of genuine puzzlement. He was apparently one of the more humorless Sangheili, of which there were many, and didn't realize that the Prophet of Inner Conviction had been indulging in self-deprecating humor. I was speaking lightly, said McKen. Even a prophet must do so occasionally, especially when his future looked so doleful. Who else is scheduled for the mission? I am, Your Eminence, said Trok, and the other San Shyum. McKen pondered that. I may alter the crew list for this leg of the mission. I strongly feel that the greatest danger is an attack on the dropship itself. I will need you to remain with the dropship to protect it. Trok grunted. I see the wisdom of the Prophet. I shall take the Hurrigok with me, because there is a special relic we hope to find and take with us, and he may be of use. Ranger Vil Kathami can come along to communicate with him. I have not that particular skill. Vil seemed to tense at that, but McKen had made up his mind. The image of the vengeful Vitality's pilot appeared in a holograph over McKen's chair panel. Sir, we are about to enter slipspace. All passengers and crew are advised to take up stations. Very good, Captain. I'll be in my station quickly. He turned to the others. You heard him. Get to your stations. We are on our way to Jonjur Kom. How long had it been? 1,000 solar cycles since the San Shyum descended from reformists had set foot upon the homeworld. His 3-fingered hand shook as he tapped the arm of his chair, and drifted toward his station, the true home of his people, and he was to see it. There was a strong possibility he wouldn't come back alive. But perhaps, after all, it was worth it.